I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, represented by CBS News Radio and Richard Epstein, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow of the Hoover Institution. He teaches law at the University of Chicago and NYU, is here to comment on a new piece of legislation that's much in the news. It's shorthand HR1. The formal name is For the People Act. This is about voting in the future in the United States for Congress, for the presidency. But really, it's also about the Constitution and the history of the country. Richard, I begin with a story from my memory of reading the 19th century newspapers. It was the fall of 1860, and early results from rural, then understood to be rural or distant estates, were critical for the argument about the election coming up in November of 1860. And I mentioned, my memory is that the vote would be coming in from rural Maine or rural Vermont, and they would talk about the results, not about the presidency, but about the Congress, about local elections, and that was seen as a harbinger. Now, that occurs to me might be an example of what you've identified in the Constitution. Article 1, Section 4, Clause 1, states that, quote, in the Constitution, times, places, and manners of the election is what the Congress can set. Have I understood that correctly, why they had different voting times in the 19th century because of distances? Good evening to you, Richard.
Yeah, hi. Well, I mean, the provision you quoted says in the first instance it's the states that have control over time, place, and manner of election, but the federal government could override it. There was no action whatsoever on the part of the federal government at that time to engage in any kind of overriding. So what you probably did was have several states that allowed for these early things to come forward. It's a perfectly, obvious type of situation when communications is slow and you're not quite sure how things would be done to get them in early. Today, I'm actually very unhappy about the system of early voting to the extent that it has taken place because of the following very simple observation. You vote on October 15th and on October 20th, some major event comes forward and you think that now you would like to change your preferences, but you're unable to do so. And it turns out that the vote went in one direction, but the new information would incline people in the other direction. And if you vote very, very early, you commit yourself before you get any full sense about the way in which this thing is going to play out. I don't think of this as a partisan issue one way or another. What I do is I think of it as a situation where I would like to have the time for the election to take place so that all the people in the country are going to be working off a common news base and a common information base, which you don't get when the votes start dribbling in. Of course, there are always going to be exceptions. Mail ballots for people serving overseas is, of course, the classic one. But even the difference between 2016 and 2020 in terms of the number of people who started to use very early mail ballots was a very important change in the way in which this particular election is run. And I do think that it's subject to the kind of problem that I mentioned. Generally speaking, there's also a fraud issue. If you're trying to control against the possibility of getting the wrong kind of ballots into the system, chain of custody is very, very important. And the mail ballots go out to addresses. People turn over 10% every year between one place and another. So there are lots of ballots that go to places where there's nobody there. And somebody can go around and harvest the ballots and put them into the machine. It's going to be yet another kind of difficulty that you're associated with it. So I do not like mail balloting in this particular fashion because I think it's very difficult to keep the chain of custody under serious control.
All right. Let me see if I understand then. The states have, in the 19th century, this is a period when we were largely rural and agrarian, and there were no roads and conveniences to transport people, and the weather changed early on. All right. At that time, certain states could set an early voting moment and then report those results over the course of weeks, and there would be trends that were reported. But the Congress never had control of when the election was to be taking place. Is that correct, Richard?
At that time, they never did. There was this residual power. Elections are kind of schizophrenic. There are several places in the Constitution where you see a conscious division of labor between the state and the federal government. And the organization of state militias is governed by a set of rules that are set by Congress to make sure that when people from different states are called up into federal service, they're interoperable one with another. And the voting system was like that. The legislatures of the states would do it. on time, place, and manner for congressional elections, but Congress could displace them except for the place of choosing senators. Now, why the senator thing? That's not related to anything that's current today. If you recall, choosing of senators was done by state legislatures under the original constitutional design, and if the federal government can do that meant that they could control where state legislatures were going to meet and how they were going to operate, and that was thought to be a much greater intrusion on what went on. Now that senators are popularly elected, that kind of provision looks to be constitutionally anachronistic. This is what always happens with a constitution that's subject to piecemeal amendment, is that things don't always fit together and you don't worry about it. And until recently, nobody even wanted to talk about the sort of the federal control of the election. It's the We the People Act or For the People Act, which has tried to essentially radically change the term. I don't think that the time, place, and manner covers everything about a congressional election, and I think there are some difficulties there. And, of course, the presidential system is completely different because there the elections are not done by popular vote or the way in which the Senate is done by state legislatures. It's done by the Electoral College. This, again, is part of the original constitutional scheme that sounds very foreign to people today. But the whole emphasis of the Republic, if you're thinking about this, is 1789 or 1787, was you had different modes of selection for different bodies. And so they had one vote for the president, and they had one vote for the Congress, and a different kind of system for the House of Representatives. And they did this because they were worried about kind of mob rule, and they thought that if you had three different kinds of systems, it would be much more difficult for a tyrant or some evil force to take over the system. When they did jury selection in the medieval period, they were very nervous about that. So they had one jury select, the second jury which selected, the third jury which finally selected or decided the particular cases. So systems like this were very common early on. The impulse that you have today is exactly in the opposite direction. People are starting to think about single popular votes as being the only way in which you ought to decide a presidential election. Scrap the Electoral College and everything else in it. And so the earlier constitutional system looks a little bit odd. But that's the one that we have to deal with when we evaluate the For the People Act.
You quite correctly point to the example of the 19th Amendment, women's suffrage in 1920, how that would have been handled completely differently today than it was in 1920. It was the states. So some states were allowing women, were saying women vote. Some states were not. And there was even a member of Congress elected. I believe my memory is from Colorado. Early on, where other states were still refusing women to vote.
Yep. I mean, what happened early on is that the first state to allow women's suffrage was in the 1860s was Wyoming. And the explanation was that they had a lot of settlers out there and very few wives, and if you wanted to get women to come in, giving them a stake in the political participation might well start to bring them there. So the states could allow for suffrage, and many states did. But it was only by the time that you got the 19th Amendment, right after World War One, that the suffrage became guaranteed nationally. This has not only happened in the United States. Women's suffrage was brought into Great Britain at the end of the First World War. And the explanation, it becomes pretty clear. Here you were treating women as fair flowers, nervous, neurotic types, was the common caricature. And then you're running a war, and all of a sudden they're running the munitions factory. And it becomes extremely difficult when women play such an essential role in the wartime economy and return to peacetime and say, you know what, you really don't count as anybody who ought to have a say in the political election. So both systems operating under very different constitutional arrangements within 2 years of each other made the same basic decision to have women in the election. Remember, the 1920 election, women voted. Not something that took a long time to implement. Boom, there it was. I mean, you know, and we've never looked back.
The member of Congress was from Montana. My memory slipped through the wrong western state. Forgive me, Jeanette Rankin. Richard, about the Electoral College, you went quickly over it. I want to touch it again. The Electoral College, understood and originally, has changed considerably so that now electors are compelled to follow the party vote unless they're faithless electors. But is the HR1 contemplating removing the Electoral College entirely? That's been a debate for some time by the Democrats.
No. It's not controlling that. What it's trying to do is to essentially dictate the terms by which the states run their elections for federal elections, where they can then use their own rules, having two sets of rules for state elections. And the difficulty on the presidential side is you do not have an analogy to the time, place, and manner restriction that you see. You just get a categorical restriction in there, which says that the legislature shall determine who shall, in fact, represent them in the Electoral College. And what happened was originally the electors went and they went to deliberate. And one telltale sign of that is if you look at the provision, it says that certain people who already have positions in government are not eligible to be electors because if it's a deliberative body, conflicts of interest start to matter. Once it turns out these people are simply functionaries, they take a ballot and they put it in a box and they don't have any deliberation. I don't care who the elector turns out to be so long as they can be bound. So that system got started in the early part of the 19th century. It's been around for 200 years, and no longer do we have a deliberative body. What we do is we have this system. And what happened in Pennsylvania and other places is that the courts started to say, well, our state constitutions infringe upon the way in which the legislatures ought to decide these particular matters. And that was a huge bone of contention. And I thought it was a rather sad story, particularly at the Supreme Court level. I regard this charge as a very powerful charge. And when it was raised before the election in September, where there was time to do something, it turned out the Supreme Court didn't want to take the case. Because it was the state figuring out how the state ought to do things. That's just wrong in my view. Turns out this is a federal constitutional provision that has a division between state and federal government, and the Supreme Court has every right to involve itself in this case, but they didn't do it. Then after the election, the challenge is renewed, and the majority of the Supreme Court said, oh, this is moot. So what you do is you're left with a situation where there's a major structural issue under the Constitution, which is unresolved, or resolved incorrectly, in my view, by the Pennsylvania court. And you have a Supreme Court which says, first it's too soon, and then it's too late, so it never comes at the right time. And the doctrine of mootness, I think, is perfectly sensible. If it turns out that an issue has been resolved and is incapable of coming up again a second time. But you certainly don't want to use mootness in a case in which it was first dismissed as premature, and then it's too late. And so under those circumstances, I think they should have decided this particular issue because it's going to come up again in the 2024 election. And I actually think that it's a pretty clear case, as Justice Thomas in a very powerful dissent said, that when you say the legislature, say the legislature. And if you have a provision in the Constitution which talks about fair and equitable election, which is the kind of language you had in the Pennsylvania Constitution, I can't believe that that's a lever. To tell you exactly when your deadlines have to be for absentee ballots. And I think it's extremely important for ballot integrity that these things all be harvested and collected at the same time so that you don't have any shenanigans or gameplay with respect to ballots which are uncertain in terms of their origin and the validation and so forth. And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court was willing to get rid of some of the authentication and notarization requirements that have been traditionally required. So I think, in fact, it was a completely rogue decision, and I think they should have been slapped down and slapped down very hard. But this is the new Supreme Court, and it's not a 6-3 conservative majority. I think what you saw in this case is something rather different, which is that we have three blocks of three on the Supreme Court. We have three conservatives, Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch. We have three kind of centrist conservatives, which would be Amy Barrett, Kavanaugh, and the Chief Justice, and three liberals, which would be Kagan, Sotomayor, and Breyer. So, I mean, it's a rather different situation. And the three in the middle essentially all signed on for the one-sentence mootness directive, so that we never did get an authoritative determination as to whether or not state Supreme Courts could override state legislatures when the protection of state legislature is not something of state law, but is part of the federal Constitution.
Quickly, Richard, I want to turn to the partisanship here when we come back. This involves the filibuster and the ambition of those who pass the H.R. 1 in the House to have it pass in the Senate for the 2022 or 2024 election. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show with Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution.